from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. All is not right in Mudville. The Major League Baseball Players Union met today outside Chicago, leading off the agenda whether to strike, and if so, when. The last player strike was in 1994, and there was no World Series that year. This strike threat is casting a shadow over the All-Star game that calls batter up tomorrow night in Milwaukee. Baseball has a long history of labor disputes. The Major League has seen 8 work stoppages since 1972, and animosity between owners and players now seems to be part of the game. Owners say they are billions of dollars in debt and the game's very survival is at stake. Players say, open the books and show us the money. Stuck in the middle are the fans who love the game but hate just about everything that now comes along with the price of admission. Attendance in ballparks still hasn't recovered to the 1994 levels. Fans still in the stands are aging. Has your love of the game waned? What would a baseball strike mean to you? And can baseball still claim to be the great American pastime? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Truro, Massachusetts, is Mr. Baseball Economics, Andrew Zimbalist, author of Baseball and Billions, a probing look inside the big business of our national pastime. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Zimbalist.
Thank you, Tom. Good evening.
Good to have you. Andrew, we're also joined by the studios of Vermont Public Radio tonight by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. I'll get it out, Jack. It's good to have you.
Play ball.
play ball. Let's do it. Andrew Zimbalist, what does even the possibility of a strike mean for Major League Baseball in 2002?
Well, I don't think the possibility means very much. I think if there is a strike and the season is disrupted and there's no World Series, that the impact will be greater than it was in 94. And as somebody said at the top of the show, at the top of the hour, you're very unlikely to have Cal Ripken reappear breaking Lou Gehrig's record. And it's very unlikely that you can have Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, and Barry Bonds breaking home run records to bring the fans back.
That was a magic elixir that pulled baseball out of the 94
ditch. Well, and one other factor, which is that since 1995, we've had practically a dozen new stadiums come online.
Does this help or hurt?
The stadium boom has already happened. It's not going to happen all over again. Mm-hmm. So baseball really has to think twice before they give us another work stoppage.
Well, we see that the Chicago meeting today did not come to the conclusion to call a strike, but union head Donald Fair is saying that it could still happen, that they're holding the possibility open. They're going to spend the next couple of weeks going around to individual teams and taking people's temperature. Why has it come to this again, Andrew Zimbalist? Why can't baseball management and players just work it out? There seems to be, if not, it looks like a lot of money to a layman's eye.
You know, I think that the answer is really quite complex, and there's no simple proclamation that you can make either to the effect that the owners are making a lot of profits or they're making no profits or that they're good guys or bad guys. The issue here is that baseball does have a screwy economic system where teams on the top these days have a terrific advantage, not only economically but competitively on the playing field, that over time that is going to cause interest in the game to wane, and something needs to be done about it. But the argument that Bud Selig is making, which is that there's this growing debt that's now $3.5 billion, and that three-quarters or even nine-tenths of the team are losing money year after year, that's a bunch of malarkey as well. I mean, it's true that debt has gone up, but think about it. If you had the choice to build a new stadium and take on, if you were a team, you'd take on $100 or $150 million in debt, but as a result of that debt that you got to raise your revenues $50 or $60 million a year, that would be a good deal for you. Your debt would go up $150 million, but the fact that your revenues are going up at $50 or $60 million a year, that would make you a more profitable and a more valuable entity.
So this is good debt in a sense. It's created a more valuable property.
Well, very largely it is good debt. And again, it's difficult to simplify, but the fact that debt has gone up doesn't mean very much by itself. Revenues, after all, in baseball have been growing at 17% a year since 1995.
Even though attendance has been flat and down 5.7% this year, I think.
It's down 5.7% this year, that's correct. But I'm talking about revenues growing since the last work stoppage until 2001 through 2001. There's 17% growth a year. Basically, revenues went from $1.4 billion up to $3.5 billion.
That's very strong growth.
It's very strong growth. And baseball has an opportunity to build on that. Instead, they're sending out these very mixed and negative messages to the fans. And it's very unfortunate, but they're kind of locked in their own history, both the players and the owners.
But as you describe it, Andrew Zimbalist, if the debt is actually kind of productive debt that's built stadiums and is bringing in more revenue, if revenue is growing 17% a year, this would make it sound as though the players might have the better case here, that they deserve a richer raise.
Well, I'm not sure that the players are asking for a richer raise. The player share in baseball revenue is about 52 or 53%, and it's been at that level since the mid-1990s. It hasn't gone up. If you have the player share being the same and revenues are growing at 17% a year, what that means is that the owners have an additional $800 or $900 million in revenue that they didn't have in 1994 or 1995 that doesn't get paid to the players. Where is that going? The country has been experiencing a 2 or 3% rate of inflation. 2 or 3%. And that doesn't eat up that $800 or $900 million. There is a lot of mismanagement out there. There is a lot of hokey pokey. There's a lot of playing with statistics, all of which is not to say that the game doesn't have economic issues. It does. There is a competitive imbalance that is a result of the intensifying revenue imbalance. Something needs to be done about it. Now, back in July of 2000, Bud Selig's handpicked committee, the Blue Ribbon Panel, turned out a report after studying baseball's economics for 18 months. This is Bud Selig's committee. And that committee recommended three things. They recommended increased revenue sharing to 40 to 50%.
That is moving revenue around so that it's not just the Yankees who sit on a pile of gold.
Well, they already have that system, but they want to
increase
that system. A luxury tax on high payrolls and internationalizing the draft along with a competitive balance draft. Those were the three things they recommended. And they also said explicitly that if baseball can do these three things, we don't need to contract. Baseball doesn't need to contract.
To kill some teams.
Two to four teams. So Selig doesn't do anything at all about starting collective bargaining. All of a sudden, after the great World Series we had last year, he announces that baseball is going to contract. That's even before he starts collective bargaining. Then once collective bargaining finally starts, he says, we're going to introduce a 60-40 rule or implement the 60-40 rule, which is a backdoor salary cap. He says that he's going to create a discretionary fund of $100 million plus that he can use however he wants to reward the teams that are behaving the way he wants them to behave. And they're going to allow owners to walk away from salary arbitration. That's what he puts on the table.
So
none of those additional things were called for in his own panel's report. So I think that what he's kind of doing is saying to the Players Association, screw you, I'm going to slap you around, I'm going to break you, I'm going to do things that are way beyond what my own commission told me to do. And what is the Players Association supposed to do in that context? Well, they've got to defend themselves to some degree.
Boy, I think, Andrew Zimbalist, this year I'd want to have you in the Players Union corner. Jack Beatty, the numbers we're throwing around here are big and the economics get complex, but at bottom, isn't this supposed to be, and I know it's an old song, but isn't it supposed to be a game that the nation takes joy in?
Well, there's less and less joy in Mudville every year, of course, as we read about this kind of economics. You know, what strikes me here is the Enron parallel. I mean, here you have people, executives.
Say it isn't so, Jack. Not baseball.
Here you have executives, and I mean the players are executives too. Everybody is going maximum for their own self-interest, and they're letting the stockholders of the fans look out for themselves. I mean, it's a kind of recipe for suicide within the industry. I mean, do they ever need an independent commissioner who can have some, you know, credible leverage on either side? Instead, they've got this guy who is really a shill, a former owner himself. His daughter is an owner. It's a rigged deck.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, does it look like a rigged deck to you, Andrew Zimbalist?
Well, it is as far as the commissioner's office is concerned. Mm-hmm. The commissioner in baseball, since they began the institution in 1920, has never really been independent of the owners. But the commissioner has never been an owner before either. Mm-hmm. And in the past, at least, there was some semblance of independence, mm-hmm. that every once in a while the commissioner would act in the best interest of baseball and would elevate himself above the self-interest of the owners and do something sensible. That hasn't really happened since Seeley came in. And in that sense, there is a rigged commissioner's office.
Andrew Zimbalist, Jack Beattie, stand by. I want to invite into our conversation now Dave Kindred. He's columnist with the Sporting News and author of Glove Stories. Good evening and welcome, Dave Kindred.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Good to have you. Dave, what's going on here? Is there something unique to baseball that's different from other large American sports that makes it vulnerable to this kind of storm every few years?
Well, probably history. You know, from 1880 on, owners have been trying to impose salary caps on players. I think there's 100 years or more of bad history. Even Seelig admits that now, that owners have abused players. Jim Boughton had a famous quote maybe 10, 15 years ago saying that the owners abused players for 100 years. We've only abused the owners for 15. We've got 85 more to go.
Oh, perish the thought. But is there some reason baked in the cake here that baseball should be more adversarial than basketball or football?
I think just that ugly, bad blood history. You know, football, the NFL, again, it's Seelig's model that he keeps talking about now, that the NFL in its early days decided to share all revenue.
Mm-hmm.
A different animal. They decided then that if Green Bay were to exist alongside New York, for instance, that they needed to share revenues equally. They were able to do that because it's a different kind of television program. It's much more compact. It's a national broadcast instead of all the local broadcasts.
Mm-hmm.
I think baseball owners traditionally have been mavericks. They've never agreed with each other. And that has hurt them from the start, because they've all been independent, selfish mavericks.
Andrew Zimbalist, we see the Yankees' payroll now reaching something like $137 million. That's $20 million ahead of the of anybody else, I guess, and about $100 million ahead of the Expos?
Mm-hmm.
This is a gigantic advantage. Is revenue sharing increase on the horizon that could somehow level the playing field a bit between these teams?
Well, they introduced revenue sharing back in 1996, in the 1996 agreement, and the present status of it is that each team is taxed at 20% of their local revenue minus their local stadium expenses. And the owners are calling for an increase up to 50% of that, although they want to shift from a split pool to a straight pool system. That's too complicated to get into. But they want to basically increase the tax on local revenue by 2.5 times. The players are saying that they're willing to increase the tax, but they're not willing to go nearly that high.
Why do the players care?
Well, they care for a number of reasons. One, the most important reason they care is that let's take the Yankees signing of Jason Giambi this past off season for, I think it was $18 million,
right,
a year for about 7 years or so, or maybe 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if George Steinbrenner is sitting at his desk and he's thinking, well, this guy Giambi is really worth $20 million to me per year, and so hence he's willing to offer him $18 million. But then he's told by the commissioner's office, every time you produce a dollar, you have to give 50% of it to us. Then Jason Giambi, who before the tax was worth $20 million a year, or estimated to be worth that, is now worth only $10 million a year. And guess what? Steinbrenner's not going to be willing to pay Giambi $18 million anymore. Maybe now he'll pay him $9 million.
It's a kind of a backdoor salary cap.
Well, it's a backdoor, it's a front door tax on players, and it'll drive salaries down. It's not the same thing as a salary cap, because a salary cap, in theory, is hard. It says that each team can't spend more than a certain amount, dollar-wise, on all of their players.
Andrew Zimbalist, we've just got you for another minute before the break. If they should strike this year, what will the consequences be?
Oh, goodness. I think the consequences will be rather severe. But it really depends, of course, on what happens. What is this, the strike that begins on August 15th and then goes into the middle of next year, and hence there's another coitus interruptus and we don't get a World Series? If that happens, I think it's a tremendous impact on the revenue of the game. The game would recover, but much more slowly than it did last time around. If, on the other hand, it's a strike that begins August 15th and then they bargain, and collectively bargain effectively, and they settle it by September 1st and we have the postseason, then I think baseball recovers very rapidly. So it depends on all sorts of things.
Andrew Zimbalist, thanks a lot for being back with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Andrew Zimbalist is professor of economics at Smith College. He's author of Baseball and Billions, a probing look inside the big business of our national pastime. We're talking about the state of baseball tonight. Baseball toying with a strike. What do you think? Is baseball at risk of self-destructing? Is America's love affair with baseball waning? Is it over? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the state of baseball, about toying again with a strike. The All-Star Game is tomorrow night. They put off the strike call today, but it could still happen. It could happen in this season. What do you think? Is baseball in America slowly dying? Who's dragging baseball down? Players, owners, fans who don't care? Is the American culture somehow growing away from baseball? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by David Kindred. He's columnist with the Sporting News and author of Glove Stories. And what about it, David? Do you see, I guess I sat around over the 4th of July with a group of guys, it happens, a couple of women, who were saying, you know, baseball just doesn't seem to fit in the way it used to. Do you see a gap opening up somehow between the American mainstream and baseball, the American game?
I think there has been, and it's a psychic change in all of America in the way that we view entertainment, in the way that we view leisure time. You know, baseball once, maybe we're wrong. Maybe we look back and put this golden aura on a time that seemed romantic, seemed slower. You know, and I think the game fit that kind of pastoral idea, this idol of America, and now. Of course, America is running at maximum speed all the time. We want things to happen. We want them to happen instantly and now and just keep happening. That's why football and basketball are so intriguing, and plus they're better television games than baseball.
Because they can get in tight on the action with the camera, or why?
I think in football, certainly they can. You know, there's enough time between plays for people to gather themselves for the next. I mean, George Will had the greatest definition of football. He said it was the worst of America, committee meetings followed by violence. You know, of course, Will, as I am, a great lover of baseball. And my hero, Red Smith, once said that baseball is dull only to people with dull minds.
But
the fact is that it takes 3 hours. You know, I love baseball. I'd sit there for 4 hours. I hope the game never ends. Mm-hmm. But there are people who want it immediately, want the sensation of games. And certainly baseball is not the physical, sensational spectacle that football is. And certainly, if you've been in a basketball arena lately to watch an NBA game, it's not that sensory overload, sensory assault that basketball is. I think that is what's happening in fandom. You know, people want sensation and want it repeatedly, and baseball doesn't offer that. Mm.
Jack Beattie, we see and understand from Andrew Zimbalist earlier there's a lot of economics going on here, and we're not finished talking about them. But how about just the poetry and pace of baseball? Is it fighting the tide?
Well, you know, I coached young kids as they grew up, sort of, I guess, for 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And my observation was that the sport was at variance with their attention span. It's a skill sport. You can't do it without practicing. It's unforgiving. You know, if you succeed 3 times out of 10 in baseball, you're in the Hall of Fame. No other sport has such a low threshold. The reason it's low is there's nothing harder to do than to hit a pitch. Nothing in any sport. And so it discourages kids. That's one thing. The second thing is it doesn't give them much exercise. They stand around and they run off the field and they get a chance to run. And so it's not even physically very much fun. And so I just saw this, and I as somebody was working with the kids, trying to think of ways to get around it. But I felt I was sort of we were sort of fighting the game.
And yet, for years and years and years, people considered it an awful lot of fun, and exactly what they wanted to do.
Well, I know, but they didn't have, I think as Dave was saying, they didn't have this football thing. They didn't have the "We Will Rock You" of the NBA. You know, they had Musial, they had Mantle, they had Mays, they had the Heroes. And it was a different, the whole rhythm of the culture. It was, you know, CBS, not MTV. And it's different today for these kids. There's so much they can do with their time.
And yet, David Kindred, we see that attendance is down from last year, hasn't returned to 94 levels yet, but the ballparks are far from empty. Some teams have a really tough go of it, but others are still filling them up. Is the separation of baseball from the culture being pushed along by bad economics and bad management of ticket prices and so on?
Well, I think certainly baseball right now is at peril. Because a lot of those 40,000-50,000 seat stadiums are filled with corporate tickets. Corporate America right now is not in the best of times.
Mm-hmm.
PGA Golf Tour, in fact, has lost 11 corporate title sponsors from maybe 35 tournaments before next year.
So here's a thought. You could see an earthquake in those big boxes and all the money that pours into them if that falls away.
Well, that I think that's certainly what baseball should be worrying about. And at the same time, as someone earlier said, you know, and as Jack has indicated, there's a fall off of interest demographically. I mean, I think the youngster is no longer involved in baseball. Baseball, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, tried a series of television commercials in which they speeded up the game, you know, to make it look as if someone was colliding with the catcher every 15 seconds. or stealing home, or there was a home run.
You can do that in an ad, but you can't do it in reality.
You can do it with the handheld video games, which seem to have replaced baseball bats in many a young person's hands these days. So I'm not sure. Yeah, I think that the game is still strong. You know, it's measured against its own success right now. I mean, any activity that brings 70 million people to gather in ballparks is not on its last legs.
That's for sure.
At the same time, you know, I think that as Andrew said, that you know, they're courting disaster here, they're courting catastrophe. A year ago, after September 11th, when baseball returned on the 18th, I thought that baseball was never bigger than in those days. It never meant more in the sense of a communal gathering of both mourning and resolve. And now it risks having never been smaller. If it goes away now, I think that it'll be a decade before it gets back to where it is right now.
From last fall's temple of Yankee Stadium to a strike.
And then followed by that one of the greatest World Series I've ever seen.
It was perfect. I mean, the Yankees win games 4 and 5 with heroics that never in history had happened. And then go to Arizona, a team in the World Series for the first time, and they win game 6 and 7, win the World Series on the last pitch. No one lost in that World Series.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball won. And then, of course, 2 days later, they start talking about contraction and how the game is awful. You asked earlier, Tom, the difference. You know, football and basketball people don't knock their own product.
Mm-hmm.
And baseball, because it has this ongoing war, labor and management, has always knocked their own product. Owners have always been calling the players spoiled and pampered, and they pay them too much. The fact is, you know, salaries have been driven up not by players, but by owners. The owners have decided to pay these salaries.
Bidding for the talent. Dave Kindred, Jack Beatty, stand by. David's calling from Toronto, Ontario. Good evening and welcome, David. You're on the air.
How's everybody doing?
Real well, thanks.
My job takes me that I have to go across the border all the time, so it's like I'm a North American. I don't really even see myself as a Canadian anymore.
U.S. and Canada, all right.
Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make, here in Toronto, you just have seen the popularity of the game wane. And what I find, too, a lot of my friends, I have a couple of my friends who teach high school in the States and Canada, and they say the same thing. They don't see, when you look at that group, the age group of people in their mid-30s and younger, it's like the game is even non-existent. And every time baseball said it's making this comeback, and every time when they had that home run derby with Mark Aguirre.
Mm-hmm.
Within that age group, it's like the game doesn't exist for a lot of these people. And every time you take them to a game, it's like they're about to eat poison kind of thing. It's like, to me, there's a real disconnect between the game and a certain age group. And I think that's probably more, something baseball has to deal with much more than even their financial structure. Because I don't really see the game coming on, except for in certain particular marketplaces like St. Louis, let's say even New York, and even in a place like New York, it's still within a certain age group. You still don't see it as like a real popular type of
David,
game.
You're pointing right at this demographic issue. I want to bring in to speak to that Faye Vincent. He's a former baseball commissioner. Good evening and welcome, Faye Vincent.
Good evening. How are you, sir?
We're great. Thanks so much for being with us, Faye. I think you heard David's call just now from Toronto. We've spoken earlier about how baseball fits into American culture these days. David's pointing at the demographic issue, describing the stadiums more and more filled up with people of a certain age, not the age when you learn baseball, but the age when you look back on baseball. Do you share that observation?
Well, I'm not certain. I think if you go to a game, I certainly don't go to that many anymore, but I think you will find lots of young kids. I do think there's a problem. I mean, I think he's right to some extent, and that is that because there's been so much difficulty between the players and the owners, baseball hasn't had a chance to really focus on doing a lot more things they ought to be doing, such as working with youth baseball and developing baseball in the inner cities and making more baseball much more interesting at a lower level. So I agree with the point, though I think that, to some extent it may be exaggerated because the data I've seen shows that there's still considerable interest among young people. But I think it's a problem to worry about.
Is it possible that baseball could one day become a rarefied event, sort of like opera, that you pay huge amounts for the tickets and it's a small elite audience that looks onto it? Or does it have to have a mass base to be baseball as we know it?
Well, I think it has to have the mass base. I don't really, baseball is still the best priced of all the major sports because half the seats in any given day in baseball are empty. I think baseball hasn't figured out what the airlines have figured out, which is if all those seats are going to be empty, why not put people in them at very low cost? Why not let
fill them up?
Lots of little kids go to the games at the last minute. Mm-hmm. I think there'll be progress in those areas. But again, baseball hasn't been doing as good a job with marketing or developing the game because it spends all its time fighting over the economic issues between the players.
What's your reading, Faye Vincent, on why we're back here facing the possibility of a strike again this year? Why do we always come back to this point?
Well, because there's no partnership between the players' union and the owners. The other sports, basketball and football, have done a much better job of building some sort of collegial partnership arrangement with the unions. Baseball still has mistrust. I think I'm right, too, about this, that the real problem in baseball goes back to collusion. When the owners violated the agreement with the players and really stole $280 million from the players, an arbitrator ruled against the owners. They had to pay the players $280 million, and that did two things. It caused the union to be almost permanently distrustful of the owners, and it caused baseball to expand unnecessarily. So it was a disastrous event for baseball, and it's overlooked.
You've been there as commissioner. If you were Bud Selig today, what advice could you give him, I guess, looking on from afar about how to get things on an even keel?
Well, I think two things. One, he should settle this agreement with the players, which means he has to give them basically what they want. There can't be any great progress in getting the union to give in on any major issue. They won't do it, and they don't see the need, and baseball, the management doesn't have the leverage or the financial capacity to fight. So I wouldn't fight. I wouldn't have any risk to the World Series. I wouldn't have any more risk to the fans. I would roll the present agreement over. But then I think you have to start and try to build some partnership with these players by getting people into baseball like Steve Greenberg, who worked for me, who was very well trusted by Don Fehr. And you have to go very slowly and on an incrementalist basis, build up that relationship.
step by step. Fay Vincent, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Good night.
Fay Vincent was former baseball commissioner of Major League Baseball. We're talking about the future of Major League Baseball. The All-Star Game is on tomorrow night, and there's talk of a strike. What do you think? Would baseball survive another strike? Victor's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Welcome, Victor. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
I'm looking at the international flavor of baseball, and it's not mentioned a lot, but we have a lot of players coming in internationally from Korea, Taiwan, Cuba, Dominican Republic, and the game seems real prominent in a lot of those countries. No, we don't mention it a lot because we don't want to compare it to our game.
Mm-hmm.
It's real interesting, and we get a lot of good players in the major leagues coming in from there. So,
Victor, do you think that helps the American game in the quality of play and popularity or not?
It doesn't hurt. It helps because it makes it more interesting. It adds a bit of a novelty to it. But, again, you have this kind of North Korea versus South Korea tension between the players and the owners. And they look like they technically they're still at a state of war. And anything can spark off. Of course, you're going to have the strike. And if they do strike, I would be in support of the players because I'm in my 40s. I still like baseball. And I'm one of the ones that look on the good times of baseball, not what is happening right now. And I'll still go to a game. Matter of fact, I still love listening to it on the radio. It's more suspenseful.
What's your sense of younger listeners and viewers, Victor? Do you see the same enthusiasm among teenagers that you felt when you were that age?
No, I don't. And I think what's going to happen to fill that gap is, it was discussed before, you know, basketball and football are more active sports. I think soccer is going to come along and fill that void. There's people that may disagree with me, and you know, which is fine, but I think baseball, you mentioned before, is a skill sport, and it's also, I look at it as a scientific sport. It's like a chess game, you know, and it could be long, dull, and boring. I like it for what it is. It is a scientific game, you know, but a lot of people don't get into that. They want the activity of basketball and football.
You sound like the ideal fan, Victor. Are you going to be at the All-Star game tomorrow night? You're there in Milwaukee.
No, the tickets was all bought out before me, and they come saying they're selling them for $1,000 scalp. And I said, I'll listen to it on the radio and then save some money, have my own popcorn and sodas and stuff at home.
We will think of you savoring it there, and thank you for your call. Dave Kindred, Victor points to the international flavor of baseball. That cuts two ways. One is we get a lot of great players who come from overseas, but there's also a lot of popularity abroad. Do we still own this game?
Oh, I think we do. In fact, Sports Illustrated this week had a great piece by Scott Price on Ichiro. And what was intriguing about that is that, you know, Ichiro obviously is a great player, you know, very quick, you know, gets the bat on the ball every time. Had 230-some hits last year, probably have that many again this year. But the inference of the story was that all the Japanese players now want to play in America, and that that's going to wind up hurting Japanese baseball. So I think that we profit by all of these players coming in. I think it does add a seasoning to the game that adds interest to it.
Yeah, Jack Beattie, I have to say, watching the culture of baseball, I find it really fascinating when new players come in from the Caribbean, from Japan and elsewhere, all kinds of stories that come with them.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. You get the Cubans, then you find out that there are certain sort of, you know, square blocks in the Dominican Republic that have produced more shortstops than any place in the world. But, you know, the other side of this is that, and I don't mean this in any negative way, but we love the ethnic flavor of it now, but it makes it harder for the suburban kid to identify, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
In other words, the people aren't quite like him. The differences that we like, I don't know. It can
that
put
alienation
off
factor
yes,
in there, just a little bit. Well, hard to have it both ways. We're talking about baseball tonight, the state of baseball, about baseball toying with a strike. Is America's love affair with baseball waning? Is it over? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the state of baseball. The All-Star game is tomorrow night. There's strike talk in the air. The last in 1994 took a huge bite out of baseball's popularity. Attendance still hasn't recovered to the levels that it was in 94 before that strike. Here we are again, staring down potentially the barrel of a strike. We're joined by David Kindred. He's columnist with the Sporting News and author of Glove Stories. And now by Jamie. Welcome, Jamie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
You know, one of the commenters earlier talked about the difference between the active sports and some of the slower sports like baseball.
Absolutely.
I grew up abroad in France and in South America, so I grew up playing soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know a whole lot about baseball. I've learned a lot since I've been back. But what I think really differentiates baseball is it's really a day in the park. You're sitting there in this beautiful stadium and the green grass and... You know, as much as it is a science, it's sort of a poetry. It's like a picnic in the park, and I don't know a sport that can fill that. And as a soccer player, I can really appreciate the difference between that and any of the real active sports, and I don't know how you change that. I mean, it's just a wonderful game.
There is some kinship there between soccer and baseball in terms of the cerebral part, and as you say, the day in the park. But a day in the park itself is kind of Victorian-sounding these days, isn't it, Jamie?
Well, yeah, but... It's hard for me to imagine another sport that has the simplicity of it. And I know we can be callous and think about the how much folks are making and how much they're paying and how much the owners are taking to the bank. But I think that when it comes right down to it, there are certain things about it that are tough to overcome. And I just think for lack of a better word, there's a poetry about being out there and just enjoying yourself.
Well, it's inspired a lot of people. Jamie, thanks for your call. Dave Kindred, is that a poetry that enough Americans are going to continue to relate to that we're going to see baseball healthy in this century?
Oh, I think so. Bill Veeck, maybe 50 years ago, said that baseball was the greatest game there is, and the proof of it is that it has long survived the fools who run it. You know, baseball, you know, we've talked about the game, you know, from the first pitch to the last pitch, but maybe more than well, in my mind, certainly more than football, more than basketball, more than any of them, going to a baseball game, going to a Major League Baseball game is an all-day event. It begins when you get there early to watch batting practice, fielding practice. I mean, I was a kid infielder. I wanted to get there 2 hours before the game so I could see them taking ground balls. That was part of the day. It wasn't just whether Stan Musial hit a home run. It was what Musial looked like at first base or in left field when he's before the game. And Faye Vincent had it right when he said you go to a ballpark and you see families. You see fathers and mothers and young children there, and you don't see that at an NFL game. You don't see that at a pro basketball game. You don't see kids hanging over the railing getting autographs.
Right.
There's almost an immersion in a baseball game that does lend itself to poetry. I mean, it is fathers playing catch with sons. And I've said this often, and, you know, I mean, how many of us have gone out in the yard and played catch? Not very many of us, on the other hand, have gone out in the yard and practiced chop blocks.
there you go. Jack Beattie, it may be a test of whether we can preserve that part of the American soul, that all day in the park patience.
Well,
yes,
I think we certainly will. I mean, I have to believe that baseball is not suicidal. You know, and
yeah. But Dave, you know, one of the problems here is what's happening inside the game. You know, earlier it was mentioned that the Sosa, McGuire home run race was one of the big moments. But, you know, Sammy Sosa was interviewed on CNN by a SI reporter last week, I think. And the SI reporter said, what do you think about the steroid charges, you know, the charges that as many as half the players are taking them? He said, oh, it's terrible. I mean, we should clean up this stuff from the game. It's awful. And then the SI guy said, well, we could arrange for you to take a test in an hour here at this other place. And Sammy went into left field. He vituperated. He couldn't. It was the most awkward moment. And, you know, McGuire was taking a substance in that. And he is today a fabulous piece of research in USA Today that correlates, really, the increase in large joint injuries over the last 6 years with the increase in home home runs.
In the major league.
In the major league. And what binds them together? Large joint injuries are one of the side effects, consequences of taking steroids. While roster spots have increased 15%, large joint injuries have gone up 58%. Other injuries, 5%. And, you know, you look at a Barry Bonds. I'm not making any charges, but this guy started out at 180 pounds. He weighs 240 now.
And off the game goes, maybe on steroids. We're just about out of time. I want to thank you, Dave Kindred, for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Dave Kindred is columnist with the Sporting News and author of Glove Stories. Listeners, you can continue this baseball conversation. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, our audio archaeologist digs up some sounds of baseball in its earliest years. This is On Point.
The trade's been made, the game's been played for dollars without cents. Commissioner's getting antsy, balls are flying through the fence. History's being pushed aside by corporate entities. Loyalty walked out the door with integrity.
Although the possibility of a strike has raised questions about the future of baseball, there's no question that since its inception in the 19th century, the national pastime has captured the hearts and minds of Americans like no other sport. On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors has discovered some recordings from the very beginning of recorded sound that illustrate our century-and-a-half-long relationship with the game of summer.
Recorded sound came on the scene when baseball itself was only a few decades old. In the 1890s, Russell Hunting amused American audiences with his monologues in the character of Casey, a hapless Irishman. Here's a Columbia Cylinder recording from 1898 where Casey is an umpire who has no idea how the game is played.
Come on, Casey, come on, come on. Play ball! Play ball! Play ball! Don't bother me, don't bother me, I'm reading the rules. Oh, never mind the rules, Casey. Go on, play ball. All right, I'll make the rules myself. Play ball! Play ball! Play ball!
The initiation of new Americans into the cosmology of baseball provided endless material for Americans who'd been here a generation or so earlier. Here's Joe Weber and Lou Fields in 1916 interpreting a discussion of baseball viewed from New York's Lower East Side.
The most important thing in the baseball is the pitcher.
Oh, that's in case the players get crazy.
No.
Well, ain't the pitcher still in the water?
No, but sometimes it's filled with beer. Don't you understand? The pitcher throws the ball to the catcher past the batter.
The water?
The batter, the fellow who tries to hit the ball.
But suppose he don't hit it?
Then the umpire calls a strike.
Oh, then every union man must quit his job.
There ain't no union in this.
Well, what does the umpire call a strike for?
Just because the batter let the ball go by him.
A generation later, here's Michelle Rosenberg in his character Getzel, describing a ball game in Yiddish. Some things are the same in any language. By the 20s, baseball players were becoming celebrities. In 1927, Pathé Records brought Babe Ruth and newcomer Lou Gehrig into their sound studios to record The Home Run Twins, a heavily scripted comic dialogue.
All joking aside, Babe, what is the secret of your home run hitting? How do you stand when you hit the ball?
I stood on a flat on both feet until you came along.
And now what?
You have me on my toes.
Well, I'm going to keep you there, too.
Say, kid, lay off of that big mouth stuff.
I didn't mean anything personal, Babe.
Okay, Lou. I've got to be beating it along now.
So have I. You know, we've been talking for the phonograph. You don't suppose you've broken the record, do you?
Between the two of us, we've broken all kinds of records.
Goodbye. See you all next season.
How will they know with you when they see you?
They'll know you, won't they?
Of course they'll know me.
In the summer of 1941, we were a few months from war, but happily diverted from that eventuality by Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak.
Joe DiMaggio, we want you and I.
It had to end sometime, and when it did, in a game with the Cleveland Indians, Les Brown and his orchestra told the story in a national hit, Joltin' Joe DiMaggio.
And now they speak in whispers low of how they stopped our Joe. One night in Cleveland, oh, 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 goodbye streak, DiMaggio.
DiMaggio himself appeared on a children's record in 1950. The story of a kid who couldn't hit the ball. They called him Little Johnny Strikeout. After another hitless game, Johnny was sitting alone crying. A kind man saw the tears and engaged him in conversation. He offered him some hitting lessons. He said he knew a thing or two about baseball.
And maybe I could help you with your hitting. How would you like that?
Gee, Mr. Thanks. That'd be swell, only I...
Only what?
Well, who are you? What's your name?
Oh, just call me Joe. From now in the first place, Johnny, always remember to keep your eye on the ball. Watch it from the moment it leaves the pitcher's hand, and then in a split second, make up your mind whether you want to swing at it or let it go. If you're looking up in the air or down at the ground, you'll never be able to tell if it's a good one or a bad one, and your chances of getting a hit will be mighty slim.
After Johnny's lesson in hitting and attitude, he's up to bat in the bottom of the ninth in the championship game.
Said his name was Joe. You know, the one who taught me how to bat. See? The tall fellow standing over there.
Johnny, do you know who that is? It's Joe DiMaggio, the famous ball player.
Joe DiMaggio? It's me, I'm Joe DiMaggio.
Hey, fellas, it's Joe DiMaggio.
Hello, Joe.
Hiya.
Hello, fellas. Hello, Johnny. Well, you really showed him, Johnny, and I'm proud of you.
Gee, Joe. It was you all the time, and I didn't know it. Gee, I wish I knew how to thank you. I wish there was something I could do for you.
Well, maybe there is something you can do for me. Right now, you want to be a ball player. But someday, you might want to be a doctor or a lawyer. Or maybe you'll even want to be president. But whatever it is you do, always keep the spirit of fair play in your heart. And Johnny, one thing more.
What's that, Joe?
Don't forget to root for the home team.
Over time, baseball has become so woven into our cultural fabric that we often see the game as a metaphor. In the mid-1950s, Sister Winona Carr, who recorded gospel on the same label as Little Richard, wrote and performed The Ball Game. No subtlety here. Baseball is biblical. A string of Old Testament characters come up to bat against a wily pitcher. Who else? Satan. The bases are life's tribulations, and Jesus awaits us at home.
First base is temptation. You know the second base is sin. Third base, tribulation. If you pass, you can make it in. Old man Solomon is the umpire. And Satan pitching a game. He'll do his best to strike you out. Keep playing just the same.
No baseball piece is complete without the story of our other national hymn. In 1908, Jack Norworth, a New York song and dance man, was sitting on a subway train. He saw a sign announcing a baseball game, and the muse touched him. 15 minutes later, on a piece of scrap paper, he'd penned the lyrics to Take Me Out to the Ball Game. He asked his friend, Albert von Tilzer, to write the music. According to legend, neither had ever been to a professional ball game. Here's Edward Meeker in a 1908 Edison Cylinder recording of the song, maybe the first ever.
Casey, Casey was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad, just to root for the hometown crew every Sioux, Casey Blue. On a Saturday, her young beau called to see if she'd like to go to see a show, but Miss Kate said no. I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
Over a century and a half, this sport has made its way into our souls. In War and Peace, it's given us a reason to look forward to tomorrow. My father's a Red Sox fan. He was born in September 1918, the last time the Sox won the World Series. I asked him if he expected to see another pennant. He said he was prepared to wait. I think little Johnny strikeout, the great DiMaggio, and the Old Testament base runners would agree.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris Bonacci and Samantha Sodikson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by